Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning. I hope you all can hear me. This is, again, new and different. My talk is called, is titled The Self in the Time, in Times of Change. And I'm kind of embodying this title in this moment. This is the first time I've done a talk in this particular configuration. So here we go. I'm going to start with quoting from Pema Chodron in the beginning of her book, When Things Fall Apart. She says, embarking on a spiritual journey is like getting into a very small boat and setting out on the ocean to search for unknown lands. With wholehearted practice comes inspiration. But sooner or later, we will also encounter fear. For all we know, when we get to the horizon, we're going to drop off the edge of the world. Like all explorers, we are drawn to discover what's waiting out there without knowing yet if we have the courage to face it. Fear is a universal experience. It's not a terrible thing that we feel fear when faced with the unknown. It's part of being alive, something we all share. We react against the possibility of loneliness, of death, of not having anything to hold on to. Fear is a natural reaction to moving closer to the truth. If we commit ourselves to staying right where we are, then our experience becomes very vivid. Things become clear when there is nowhere to escape. We need to get to know fear, become familiar with fear, look it right in the eye, not as a way to solve problems, but as a complete undoing of old ways of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and thinking. The truth is that when we really begin to do this, we're going to be continually humbled. There's not going to be room for the arrogance that that's holding on to ideals can bring. The arrogance that does inevitably arise is going to be continually shot down by our own courage to step forward a little further. The kinds of discoveries that are made through practice have nothing to do with believing in anything. They have more to do with having the courage to die, the courage to die continually. Sometimes we are cornered. Everything falls apart, and we run out of options for escape. At times like these, the most profound spiritual truths seem straightforward and ordinary. There's nowhere to hide. We see it as well as anyone else, maybe better than anyone else. Sooner or later, we understand that although we can't make fear look pretty, it will nevertheless introduce us to all the teaching we've ever heard or read. The trick is to keep exploring and not bail out, even when we find out that something is not what we thought. That's what we're going to discover again and again and again. Nothing is what we thought. I can say that with confidence. Emptiness is not what we thought. Neither is mindfulness or fear. Compassion, not what we thought. Love, Buddha nature, courage. These are code words for things we don't really know in our minds, but any of us could experience them. These are words that point to what life is really like when we let things fall apart and let ourselves be nailed to the present moment. So these last 2 months have brought a lot of change. A lot of things have fallen apart. We've witnessed and experienced fear, anger, loss, disorientation, uncertainty, and even at this moment, we are uncertain about how things will play out. A friend of mine said a few days ago that uncertainty was fine to study about in the abstract, but experiencing it in reality is awful. I'm paraphrasing. His language was a bit stronger than that. It reminds me of traveling. If you travel away from your usual life and venture into a new country, whether it's a few miles away or a few thousand miles, you quickly come up against that question, who am I? My experience is that even if I go to a place where I've been before, my identity shifts. For example, instead of being a priest at Dharma Rain Zen Center, I become a minor family member of a different family. It's a little like being a different person. Disorienting, but interesting. When I go by myself to someplace completely new, I am free to be anyone I wish. I knew someone who used the opportunity of traveling to try out different identities. I'm Dana, she might say. I'm a medical illustrator at XYZ Hospital. That's one way to explore different possibilities. So travel and change can also be an opportunity to drop or at least loosen any sense of identity at all. If no one here knows me and I don't have a role to play here, then do I even exist? So much of our identity is constructed in relationship to others. What does it mean not to have clarity about roles and relationships? This is the death of a self, which I think is what Pema Chodron meant when she said we have to have the courage to die continually. It can be scary. When we encounter that fear, various other responses can arise. One might be anger. We speak of anger as contriving reality for the self. When reality as we see it is not to our liking, which is a pretty good bet when everything suddenly changes, we can get unhappy with it, angry at changes beyond our control. We usually believe that we can control things to be safe. Times like this expose that belief as illusion. Another emotion that comes up is grief. Any change brings loss, even changes that we see as positive. A young person graduates from high school and commences a new life, full of promise. And the old life is gone, never to return. We often ignore this loss, but it's there and very real. This current pandemic has handed loss both profound and trivial to many people. Loss of jobs, loved ones, health, connection to family members and friends, down to things like no in-person prom or graduation ceremony for those high school graduates, and even to no way to get hair or nails done. I confess this last one kind of mystifies me personally, but it's real for some people. I mentioned fear of death and loss of control. Fearing illness and death has to be considered. We often tend to ignore the fact that we are dying, but now we have to face it. We've been putting a lot of effort, and appropriately so, into preventing illness to the extent that we can. And yet, there are limits to what we can do. After being in isolation for 2 weeks and then going back out grocery shopping, I did what I could do. I wore a mask and gloves, unloaded groceries to the deck outside of the kitchen, disinfecting and repackaging out there before bringing things inside, washed my hands, etc. And even so, I was aware of many times and places during that trip where I could have picked up something. Let's talk about gloves. Okay, I wear gloves just to keep germs off of my hands. Very good. When I get to the cashier, I have to reach into my purse to get my wallet. Do I take my gloves off to do that and then put them back on, or a new pair? What happens when I pass someone closer than 6 feet, or maybe brush up against a wall or other objects? Do I need to take off my outer clothes when I arrive back home and disinfect them? How far do I go with this attempt to control my environment? So many questions, so many ways to become exposed to invisible germs. I see lots of confusion out there on Facebook about what to do, how far to go to stay safe. It seems that it makes the most sense to follow a middle way, do what we can, and hope for the best. Isolating completely brings its own problems and risks. Social isolation has been identified as a risk factor, particularly for elderly people, of increased vulnerability to disease and ill health. And really, it's almost impossible to isolate completely, to lock yourself into some sort of bubble, And even if you could, where does food come from or waste go? How does laundry get done? It's simply not possible to completely cut oneself off from others. It's worth mentioning that it's also true that isolating is a privilege denied to many who have no choice. These confusing conditions bring about a disorientation that can be dizzying. When you're traveling, the terrain can be unfamiliar. We can get lost if we're not careful, and sometimes the harder we try to find our way out, the more lost we get. One way to counter the ill effects of isolation is to foster connection. How can we do that while remaining physically distant? After all, physical presence is important. There is something vital about it. There was an interesting thread this last week on the Soto Zen Buddhist Association email list where one priest was arguing that a gathering that happens online can't legitimately be called a sesshin, which is the Japanese word we usually use for a silent retreat. He was arguing that physical presence is required for that kind of training to happen. Others disagreed. And of course, we just had our first online sesshin here at Dharma Rain a couple of weeks ago. Always granting that there is something essential about physical presence, several other priests and teachers came up with eloquent descriptions about how nourishing people have found online presence. And we found that to be true during Denkwe Sesshin here. One person came up with the word zazum instead of zazen. One drawback to Zoom is that chanting doesn't work well online. That is, if everyone tries to chant together, we quickly find that we're off beat with each other, and as Chosen Bays puts it, hilarity ensues. So one person chants, and others chant on their own while muted. Something is definitely lost when we can't hear each other in person. At least here at Dharma Rain, you generally get to hear the residents in the hall chanting together instead of just one person. But there's something about chanting, both hearing each other and producing sound together that resonates in the room, that creates a special kind of energy and harmony. This is lost online. And yet, there's still something sweet about knowing that several of us are chanting together. For some of us, this new Zoom world represents one of the many changes that are so unsettling. Still, these changes also have happened before. From the ancient oral tradition to writing, to printing, and now to digital dissemination of knowledge. This increase of remote communication is transforming how people work and how they stay in touch with each other. Each change has been monumental and has brought a storm of criticism. Yes, something is lost each time. But something is also gained. In this situation, it has allowed many of us to maintain connection with each other and thereby to maintain some sense of who we are in the world. So that's that sense of self. Here's another way to look at the self. This also comes from the SZBA list in a thread about Vaisak. This celebration of Buddha's birthday happens in the spring, and we will be celebrating it next Sunday, May 3rd. It's celebrated in all branches of Buddhism, usually with lots of children and flowers. Our celebration this year will still include flowers, but the children and many others have to participate remotely. Here's what Josho, a priest at Chapel Hill Zen Center, says about one aspect of this ceremony. The legend of Buddha's birth that we use seems to be found in Chinese and Japanese Buddhism. That is, when the baby Buddha was born, he took 7 steps and pointed up with one hand and down with the other hand and said, "Below heaven and above earth, I alone am the world honored one." So when we do the ceremony, we have a little statue of the baby Buddha, and he has one hand, sure enough, pointing upward and one pointing downward. I think this statement puzzles most of us. It doesn't sound like Buddhism, much less like Shakyamuni Buddha. I brought this up with Daitsu Tom Wright, a disciple of Uchiyama Roshi, the first time I met him. And Daitsu says this is not a good translation, and it's unfortunate that it's used so much in English. He said the term translated as I is jiko, which in 20th century secular Japanese is used to mean our usual psychological self. But in Buddhism or Soto Zen, jiko is used to refer to life force itself. So we could say, below heaven and above earth, life force is most honored. Or, the living energy we share with everything is most important. In other words, honor life. Fits very well with Earth Day. And then also this, continuing the same thread from another priest, Kokyo. Keizan's Denkaroku, chapter 1, also has a commentary on this word, I. Commenting on Buddha seeing the morning star and saying, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. In this case, I is ga instead of jiko, which can also be used for true unconditional self. So I'm going to read from the Cleary translation of what he's talking about here. And this is the story of Shakyamuni Buddha. That is to say, I is not Shakyamuni Buddha. Even Shakyamuni comes from this I. And it does not only give birth to Shakyamuni Buddha, all beings on earth also come from here. Just as when you lift up a net, all the holes are raised, in the same way, when Shakyamuni was enlightened, so too were all beings on earth enlightened. And it was not only all beings on earth that were enlightened. All the Buddhas of past, present, and future also attained enlightenment. While this is so, do not think of Shakyamuni Buddha as having become enlightened. Do not see Shakyamuni Buddha outside of all beings on earth. Even so, I and together are neither one nor two. Your skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are all together. And the host inside the house is I. It does not have skin, flesh, bones, or marrow. It does not have gross physical or mental elements. Ultimately speaking, if you want to know the undying person in the hut, how could it be apart from this skin bag? So you should not understand the beings on earth as distinct from yourself. I love this idea of the bigger self as life force. This has always been my definition of courage. What is it that allows us to keep going in the face of obstacles, change, fear, anger, and all the rest? What gets us out of bed in the morning? It's courage. Or life force, something intrinsic to all of us. Many years ago, Kyogen gave me a copy of a reading, which I have kept all this time. I don't know what book it came from. It's a short chapter marked as pages 79 and 80, or who wrote it. It refers to a time of year, perhaps a couple of months before this time in late April. It's called Young Grasses. The snow has disappeared. In the garden, the fallen leaves of last autumn are exposed now like old corpses. Through the decayed leaves, a multitude of young growing things is pushing upward. It's almost as if these young plants are saying, I have waited until this moment to arrive. I was filled with power, so I pushed my way upward. Looking at them, how can I sit still? Spring has come. Either the warmth of spring draws them out, or the grass's own powerful wish burst out. Either way, they are called by spring and grow up. Or seeking the spring, they grow up. I don't care which. Any reasoning will do. But the warm spring has come, and the green grasses are spilling out in buds. Spring is alive not only on the earth, but in the earth as well. Spring has fulfilled itself to the very tip of the grass's roots. There is no room in me to name a relationship between the two, whether one seeks the other or the other calls the one. The grasses simply are single-minded. They concentrate on breaking through everything, so they just burst out. That's the power of spring. From the roots of the chrysanthemum, buds of the chrysanthemum develop. From the roots of the peony, buds of the peony come up. Tulip bulbs do not give rise to hyacinth flowers, nor do flowers of the tulip develop from hyacinth bulbs. Isn't it funny that they never get mixed up? They have no rules or ideals, but they aren't capricious and they do not make mistakes. Each pays no attention to the other's world, but honestly puts its whole effort into its own way. I deeply respect these little growing things. I put my hands together in reverence. Honestly, courageously, strongly, in the intensity of every moment, never resting, such a real life wish manifests itself in these grasses very clearly, doesn't it? Something, that mysterious power that goes beyond the ability to reason, is manifested so naively in these young grasses. I can't help bowing my head in respect. Grasses are so tranquil and serene. They keep silence. Their whole body is full of power. Their growth is a long, wide tongue that covers the whole world. You never catch the grasses making noise. They never reject others nor advertise themselves. Grasses are not afraid of others. Those who are afraid of others always reject and attack them. The grasses are not like this. Their living is in the full field of their own life, and so they do not need language or thoughts. Reverence their tranquility. Long for their silence. And that's my talk for today. I'm open to questions and comments. All right. I can see possible, I'm not sure what I'm seeing, actually. Not quite how this works.
I see Ember's going to help.
What was that?
So, I'm guessing Ember's going to help.
Okay.
Yes,
Ember's helping. Good.
Hello, everybody. Deep bows. There's currently 63 of us. That's amazing.
Cool.
So if you could use the chat function to make any comments or questions, and I can read them out.
If they can speak better.
Just unmute them. Let me open the unmute function for people.
So you now have the power to unmute yourself.
We do have three that came in from Patrick. A question, how can we encourage courage in others?
Well, primarily by demonstrating it in ourselves. But it's interesting because I asked in Shosan at Tazahara, I asked the abbot there, how do I cultivate fearlessness? And his answer was, by being afraid. So if we can show that we're not afraid of being afraid, if that makes any sense, and that in spite of fear, we continue to move forward, I think that's the very best way to encourage that, to cultivate that in others, is by cultivating it within ourselves.
From Gary Hoff, what was the source you just read from?
I don't know. That's that was the thing, the spring grasses. I don't know. It's possible that Gyokoko knows because it's from their library, and maybe she knows, but I'm guessing she probably doesn't remember. This was many years ago.
from Don Crawford, an excited thank you, Ginkgo. So if anybody else
is cruising her library.
Oh, Gilgoco's cruising her library?
Yes, I'm looking to see if I can find what would...
I know what it is. Jiko knows.
Jiko knows?
It's Shout of Buddha by Haya Akagerasu. It's from the 1920s. I have it on my bookshelf.
Wow. All right.
That's what you have to do to be a lay teacher.
Jiko.
This is great. That's the nice thing about people being in their homes. It's like, well, let's see. Wait, I know this one. Here it is. It's cool. That was very cool. So, Jiko, if you could write that down and send it to me in an email, then I can actually put attribution on this thing from now on.
Okay, you got it.
Thank you. Anybody else? Questions, comments?
Patrick asked, can you say more about the courage to die continually? Mm-hmm.
So the way I've experienced this in the last couple of months is to recognize that my own vision of how I think things are is likely to be faulty or at least incomplete. To sit still and allow that to be, even though it's all coming up, anger in particular can be very, very emphatic. This is how things are. It's because of this, and I don't like it, and all these opinions and all these feelings come up. To allow all of that to be there, to honor all of that, and at the same time to recognize these are just feelings, these are just thoughts, these are just opinions, and to let them simply be there without attaching to them. So it has something to do with, I think, allowing yourself to let go of this particular self, of this particular idea, this particular way of looking at the world, and allowing other ideas, thoughts, feelings to come in. And even, in fact, even if you don't have those things coming in, just to simply sit there and let it all go and not know who you are in this moment. I think it's about that. That's the way I've experienced it. It may be other ways to think about it, but that's how I've experienced it.
Thank you.
Eric asked, can you talk about how to stay with a topic that is so fear-inducing that it is too hot to handle?
Mm. Well, we do have to take care of ourselves too. I think this is a matter of discernment over time about when you can sit still in the midst of being completely overwhelmed, for example, and when you need to have a break. I have gone through things where I have understood that I was stuck, in a mind state that was just spinning around in the same old grooves. And what I found, I mean, I think there's a variety of practices that you can use to work yourself through those, to find a way to interrupt those. For me, it's been chanting. It's been mantras of some sort with a mala. If you chant almost anything 108 times, your mind will change. Your mind state will change. That's what I have found. So I have a particular mantra that I particularly like, Namu Kanzayan Bosatsu, which is, I have a relationship with Kanzayan, and so that works for me. But I think there's all kinds of different mantras out there, and you can find one that works for you. That's one practice that has been helpful for me when I get to that place of overwhelm of being stuck. There are others. There's you know, there's metta practice. There's a lot of our mindfulness practices can be very helpful for this, grounding yourself in the present moment. What's happening right here, right now? What are the sensations? What are the things that I'm seeing? There's a variety of ways to bring yourself back to this place to say, you know, right now, in this moment, I'm fine. I'm really fine. I have everything I need right now. And you can hold that up against this other thing that's going on and recognize that this other thing that's going on is the mind. And it doesn't mean that it's nothing and that it doesn't matter, but you can hold both of those things at the same time.
From Autumn, I wanted to say that I appreciate the conversation about connection through cyberspace versus in meat space. I think it's so easy to diminish one over the other, instead of recognizing that connection can take many forms and kinds of personal meaning. It means a lot to see you all working to connect in a new way with the Sangha that really acts as kind of an anchor, at least for me in this time.
Yes, thank you. I think this has been, I was going to say a difficult time. Well, I guess I could say it's a difficult time for many of us. And I think that these changes are easier for some of us to encompass than for others. And I guess part of what I'm trying to say here with my talk is to recognize that yes, there is something lost and something gained, and that it all works. It can all work. We're all finding ways to make it work. And I would say also, I wanted to just to acknowledge that we have great examples in other places and other, Great Val in particular has done a lot with online. They've just sort of jumped right into it. And, you know, a lot of us have been able to follow their example. Having the ability to communicate with other Zen centers across the country has been very, very helpful in terms of seeing what people are doing and different ways that things can work. And I mean, we all just have to find ways to keep putting one foot in front of the other. So that's kind of what we're doing. So I appreciate how many people out here have been coming in and embracing this new way of being as well. It's not all us.
From Daicho, can you speak a little about how you and others are taking advantage of this isolation?
Well, I will say that Denkwe Sesshin was a lot easier in a lot of ways for us than a typical Sesshin. We weren't feeding 25 people, we were feeding our usual 7. We weren't finding places for people to sleep. There were a lot of things we weren't doing that we often do for a sesshin. There were other things, of course, that we were doing that we don't usually do. So, but it creates a particular kind of container here that has its own sweetness. So at the same time that I think we miss having a lot of people involved and to work, you know, people that we can work together with. At the same time, there is something kind of sweet about just relying on each other and a small group of people that we know and practice with regularly. Again, it's trade-offs. It's, you know, there's some things that are wonderful about it and some things that are very difficult about it. I guess the other thing I would say is we have a lot of people coming through on our property. And so we see more people and dogs and kids and a lot of activity out there that we have conversations with people that we might not have otherwise had conversations with. And it's just a different time. And there are positives to it.
We have more, 11:20.
Oh, yeah, we have them, yeah.
From Koei,
Can you speak about finding joy in these times in our immediate world when pain and uncertainty for us and those close to us is so near?
Well, I think this is always a question. It's more obvious right now. We hear a lot more about the pain and suffering of others. Finding joy is always possible. I really believe this. It is always possible to find joy. On a day like this, I feel like that's really obvious. You know, go outside and take a look at the flowers blooming and the grass is coming up and the particular color of green that we find in April. For me, that's the easiest, the most accessible. But finding joy in new things, new ways of doing things. Finding joy in sitting still and being quiet. There's a lot of different things. All of us have different circumstances still. We can find joy in circumstances, but we can also find a way to tap into that life force, that intrinsic life force that is, that's always there. Joy bubbles up on its own if you get quiet enough to let it.
From Lindsay Poor, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I want to echo some of the sentiment I've heard from others. The ability to listen to this community in real time throughout this situation continues to be a remarkable source of wisdom and strength. Thank you to the Sangha for everything that's going on to keep people connected.
You're welcome, and thank you all as well for participating in it. It means a lot to us. It helps us see that we're not just practicing all by ourselves in isolation.
From Sui Ryu, in my experience, sometimes intense fear passes and shifts when I open to it and am present with it. But other times, it seems to trigger a chain reaction. Sleeplessness, migraines, that builds and takes time to recover from. Do you have any advice about how to be present with intense fear without it triggering a chain reaction like this?
Well, that's kind of what I was talking about earlier. And and again, for me, it has been a matter of discernment, of knowing when I need to, have, many of us have, lots of old coping techniques for getting out of this stuff, right? Some of those have still been useful, and some of them I still try to keep as little sort of tools in my back pocket. And then, as I mentioned, finding new tools about finding ways to interrupt or ventilate, sometimes talking to someone, sometimes doing one of these practices I was talking about, sometimes taking a walk. There's a lot of different sort of practices or techniques, but the discernment part for me comes with, when is it time to do that? And when should I just sit still and stay with it? Because you're right. Sometimes you end up, well, I call it getting stuck, but it can also, you know, trigger some physical effects that may not be so helpful. And that's a matter of practice. It's a matter of sort of noticing and paying attention to what's going to work and what isn't going to work. It's also, I guess I would say, I haven't even mentioned this, which is odd, but it's a matter of compassion. So compassion for yourself. At some point, you begin to recognize this poor child is so scared right now. And how can I comfort this child? How can I be with this child? How can I face this unflinchingly and at the same time bring some comfort? So that sometimes is a way to look at it.
From Sosetsu, in your training over the years, there were times when you cloistered as a practice. Or in looking at other traditions, trainings cloister 3 years in walled community for practice reasons. How can this experience be used in that way? How can this be like that?
Yes. So finding ways to do this and finding ways to reframe what this experience is. We sometimes talk about this with people in prison too. It's like, okay, you're in this this horrible situation here. And how are you going to work with it in a way that is positive? So sometimes we'll use the analogy of a monastery, of being in a monastery. It's not quite the same. But if you can reframe it in your own mind to be, this is a particular kind of life practice that I can work with, then it becomes something that can actually further your spiritual growth. So, and I think the same thing is true for this period of quarantine, isolation, or what have you. Interestingly enough, I mentioned that there's some people who can't isolate for all kinds of reasons. There are people who are still, many people who are still going out every day and working with many, many people and not getting enough breaks from that. So our experience is sometimes unbalanced in that way, so that people who are too isolated or people who are not don't have enough time to themselves or all kinds of different things or are just shut up with just a few people that they may not have been the people they chose, all kinds of different experiences that we have with that. And what I think we can do is to recognize the circumstances we are in are the circumstances we are in. How do I appreciate this? How do I maximize the positives of it so that it becomes a source of nourishment and growth for me in this time? I know that for myself, when I was in what I call isolation as opposed to quarantine, that is when I was really by myself most of the time. It took a little while for me to shift in my own mind. Okay, but that was then, and that's what I was doing before. But now I'm here, and this is what I'm doing now. And to let go of the old and see what might come up in the new, in the now. And I think that's kind of what we have to keep doing all the time. Okay, what's happening right now? And how do I work with what's happening right now? And how do I appreciate it? How do I grow with it? How do I work with it? So it is, I think that is what our lives are about a lot of the time.
From Char, the abbot mentioned that it was okay to visit Dharma Rain to sit and meditate. Please be more specific about this. Thanks.
So the way our policy is set up, we are not allowing non-residents into our buildings other than the barn, which has garden stuff and whatever. So sometimes people are coming and working in the garden, for example. But it's okay to sit on our Ngawa or in the garden or other places on the property. It's fine to come and walk through. If you happen to encounter somebody, we'll probably say, oh, hi, how are you? Let's talk. How are you doing? You know? Those are all perfectly fine, obviously keeping at least that 6 foot or longer, whatever distance, so that we're still trying to be safe as possible and wearing masks, if that makes sense, all of those things. But now that the weather is getting to be nice, not consistently, but often, it can actually be wonderful. And some of us are still doing this too, actually sitting outside on the Ngawa or on a bench in the garden or other places like that. So that's completely open to anyone who wants to do that. Do you have anything to add to that? Yeah, Kakumi says, sounds good. Okay.
Angora. No, Ngawa.
Okay, I'm not hearing this.
So the next question is similar. Don asks, could you explain how people are arranging Sanzen these days?
Ah, Sanzen. So Sanzen at this point is more like informal Sanzen, which is to say you set up an appointment with someone, usually directly with someone, and you figure out a time, and you can do that either by phone or by Zoom. It works. It works pretty well, actually. During Denkaway, we had periods of time where we had Sanzen set up more along the lines of how we do it on Sesshin. And for that, you had to sign up for a time. It was all Zoom. And you had, you know, there were ways to kind of do that. It's possible. It's not exactly the same, but it has its points. And at least we can do it.
A follow-up question from Char. What is the Ngawa?
Oh, the Ngawa is the deck that runs all the way around the Soto. So there's a lot to it. I mean, it's big. And it's 8 feet wide. Is that right? I think that's right. So it's 8 feet wide all the way around the building. So what was that? 6 feet wide? Okay. Anyway, it's wide enough. And there's lots of different possibilities depending on which side, the way the wind is blowing, where the sun is. There's a lot of different ways, different places that you can choose to do that at any given time.
It's about 11:15 and we've reached the end of the list.
Okay.
Final call.